It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teaching, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So today we're talking about Bodhidharma's fourth precept, no illusory words. And here is the precept. Self nature is mysteriously profound. Unexplainable Dharma. Not to preach one word is called no illusory words. So to me, it sounds like Bodhidharma is saying, since Dharma by nature is inexplicable, the only way not to make an illusory word is to say nothing. And ultimately, this is true. Language can't capture truth. But on the other hand, human beings do need to communicate. We really do. And so we need to use words. But it's good to know that the word itself is illusory. I'd like to start by sharing with you a little tiny bit of Koban Chino Otogawa's words to his students in the Zendo. There are just a few sentences of his that I think are important. He starts out saying, what is unreal and what is real is a very big subject for all of us. The life we live feels fantastic, but it's like a continuous dream. Our experiences of the past 20 years, 40 years, even 70 years, where are they? It feels like all are embedded in the present moment and the dynamic life we live. When we look into our past, the words we have spoken to ourselves and others show a narrow perspective. Even if we make our best effort not to lie, not to speak untruth, still we feel we have many times spoken illusory words. We are afraid we might still be doing this and that this must still be going on. And I think he's captured a really deep and hardly spoken about quality of ourselves. Hardly spoken about. He continues, it's very difficult to describe an actual thing in language. The word cat is the word cat. That's all. It's just the word cat. That word cannot become the cat. It merely points to something. If we can experience something together with another person, we don't need so many words. But communication can be complicated. When I say zafu, all of us understand it. But for people who don't know that a zafu is a black cushion, zafu is just a sound. Also, zafu doesn't point to something we don't know. But that invisible realm is important when we discuss communication. The words invisible realm, now that's what Koban has to say. And I want to say that the words invisible realm, which on the one hand beautifully express the inexplicable nature of why saying our truths via language is so elusive. as they speak, they're committing the very crime they're talking about. In Coben's mind, the words invisible realm, even their elusive quality, has a certain color and texture, an entire fabric of life that I will venture to say that no one to whom he addresses them shares. This is what's so elusive about language. It is because no one shares precisely the way he experiences the world and from there languages it for himself. And so now we're already two steps away from reality. So there's actual reality, and then there's our experiencing actual reality, and then there's our languaging, experiencing actual reality. So insert that into someone else's karmic consciousness, and you're almost lost. If someone else doesn't share the same culture, education, childhood experiences, sense of values, et cetera, there's little hope Coben will make his point at all. But this is the almost ridiculousness of it. In the other person's mind, a point might have been made, and they agree, and no one even notices that nothing accurate has been said. And I would venture to say this is happening right now as I speak, that probably not even two of us have the same idea of what invisible realms, or invisible realm means. Not even two of us. And I think actually that's because our karmic consciousness, the seventh one about the self, and the eighth one, the Elias storehouse of all of our experience, so dominates our unconscious that communication is very difficult. It's very difficult. So another level of mystification is ethical. So at what point is something a lie, actually? How do we measure it? So in the above scenario, everything said out loud would be a lie technically, because words lie, basically. A word is just a word. A word is strictly itself and nothing more than that. Or you could say perhaps that its invisible realm is so large that the truth part all but vanishes in it. That's another way of saying it. But I want to get in now to the ethical part of language, of language being mysterious. By telling you a story of a film that was made it was a Polish film made in Poland. It takes place in Poland in 1962. And I highly recommend this film. It's called Ida. And I'm going to tell you the story of this film because it brings up a huge ethical situation. So on the eve of her vows to become a nun, an 18-year-old novice, Anna, is told by the mother superior that she has received a letter from Anna's aunt who would like to see her. Anna, who is an orphan from birth, has no interest in this. She doesn't want to go, but the mother superior insists. And this aunt, whose name is Wanda, and from the looks of her apartment is quite well-to-do, turns out to be a cynical communist judge. She shows Anna pictures of her mother and father, tells her that she's Jewish, and that her name is Ida. It's a big shock to Anna to find out that she's Jewish on the eve of her becoming a Catholic nun. Anna wants to find their bodies so as to give them a proper burial. And Wanda reluctantly agrees. And most of the movie is about their adventure of getting the dead bodies of her parents buried properly. But as they're driving along back to Wanda's old home, which would have been her mother's old home and hers when she was born, they pick up a hitchhiker who happens to be a saxophone player in a band that's going to celebrate the centennial of the town. And he and Anna's in the front seat and he's in the back seat, but they kind of notice each other. You feel that. And later in their hotel room, the aunt, Wanda and Ida's, let's say, Anna's or Ida's hotel room, the aunt has been drinking and she starts mocking Anna's spirituality. And they have a fight. So Anna has made it clear that she doesn't want to go to the celebration. It's not exactly what novices on the eve of their taking vows, you know, are into. But needing to get away from her aunt in their room where they're fighting, she goes downstairs where the celebration is happening and during an intermission talks with the sax player. And needless to say, there's tons of chemistry and there was already chemistry in the car. So that's going on. Then lots of ugly things happen regarding who killed her parents, probably to save them from the Nazis. And didn't kill her. And when Anna returns to the convent to prepare to take her vows, she becomes aware that she's not ready. She tells God that she is not ready, and the next day watches the other novices take their vows. Meanwhile, she learns that her aunt has committed suicide. She walked out of the window of her apartment. So Anna returns to the city and attends the funeral of her aunt, and the sax player is there. And alone in her aunt's apartment, she takes off her veil and she experiments with all the things, you know, drinking and smoking. Her aunt was a serial smoker. And she puts on her aunt's sexy clothes, and she goes to see the sax player that night. And they make love. And then she asks, what's next? And the sax player casually responds that his band is going to a certain town and she's welcome to come along. And then under further pressure, he says, they could get a dog, a house, have children, live life. And then I guess he falls asleep. And so early the next morning, Anna puts back on her veil. And while he's still sleeping, quietly leaves. And she's last seen walking down a snowy road back to the convent. And we feel that she's surely ready to take her vows. So it's how this film was beautifully done. And this is an aside. The actor who played Anna was not an actor. She was found, the director couldn't find someone. And he found this, he saw this girl in a coffee shop who I can't remember what she was studying, but anyway, she was a student, and he asked her if she would play the part, and she agreed, and she did it just so well. It was just such a moving film. So, but my purpose in telling you the story is about the aunt, Wanda. So instead of death or a concentration camp, she chose to work for the Communist Party. And she became a judge. And in doing so, she sentenced a lot of her own people to death. And we learn from various conversations that she had with Anna as they were driving that she was racked with guilt about this. She would say, "I have put people to death." They'd be driving in the car and she'd, "I have put people to death." And she fully felt what she had done. So first she joined the Communist, she chose to join the Communist Party. She became a successful prosecutor. She enjoyed a nice apartment, and then she jumped out of her apartment window and killed herself. So where are the lies in this picture? That's for you. Where are the lies in this picture? And as you're contemplating this powerful question, I will remind you of a few things we've already learned about lying. One from Reb is that in the practice of the Bodhisattva precepts, since our ultimate concern is for the welfare of all beings, we extend the meaning of not lying to include not standing by in silence when others speak in a false or harmful way. Now, this, of course, is very hard and sometimes impossible, and I'm sure it was impossible in Germany at that time. But I'm just saying that's one of the aspects of not lying in the Bodhisattva precept of no illusory words, which includes lying. Reb also says that both self-loathing and self-praise are tools in the service of self-concern. And as long as the basic illness of attachment to self has not been cured, self-praise and self-blame will reign supreme. So Wanda was full of self-blame. And this is about attachment to self. And attachment to self is delusory, because the self doesn't exist as we see it. Only the interconnected, the only thing that actually does exist is the interconnection with all beings. So Reb calls it the basic illness of attachment to self. As long as that has not been cured, self-praise and self-blame will reign supreme. And then he says, all speech based on self-concern. So all speech based on self-concern, which is self-praise or self-blame, is harmful or false. And speaking the truth naturally arises from selflessness. When we are caught in self-protection and self-promotion, we cannot speak the truth. In the end, truth-speaking is the only way out of bondage to self-concern. That is a huge statement, that if we're going to get out of this attachment to ourself that is prevalent everywhere. Reb is saying, in the end, true speaking is the only way out. And I think he means that that kind of interior exploration and honesty, plus Zazen, will elicit the realization of our interconnectedness with all beings. So freedom from selflessness does not come from pretending that we're not selfish. It is realized through the complete study of our selfishness, which practicing not lying helps. So we have to go directly toward. We can't pretend that this isn't so. We have to go directly toward it, which is partly why I'm talking about it. We go directly toward our selfishness. And so for example, Wanda, instead of killing herself, which adds yet another killing to her list of killings, she might have looked at herself with compassion, forgiven herself, because it isn't 100% sure that she did the wrong thing, repented and moved on to live a generous and wholesome life, perhaps helping many people with her considerable skills. So when Hitler killed himself, things changed, and she might have been able to use her very sharp mind in a different way, in a more useful way, for benefiting beings. Of course, she was so cynical. That was what their fight was about. She was very cynical about religion in general. And she mocked Ida, her Anna, for being uppity, kind of, which was not at all how she was. So here are 12 other homes for illusory words. So now this is, I'm making this up. There's 12 other places where illusory words can be found easily. And the first one is speaking with the intention to deceive, misrepresent, withhold, or hide some aspect of the truth. And this often takes the form of withholding a part of the truth that's the relational nugget or appended to the relational nugget, and leaving that part out, thinking of oneself as honest without starting an argument. And the not starting an argument part is the most important point in the mind of the one withholding. So it's emotionally as well as verbally dishonest. An argument doesn't have to be fighting. It can be a conversation, which the person who has something to hide might begin, actually. I'd like to talk about such and such because it's bothering me, and I find that I'm not talking about things that are important, something like that. Okay, the second one is it's easier to lie when we're unaware of doing so. Carelessness and self-deception smooth the path. And with the aid of self-denial, we can become confidently self-righteous in our lie, and whole religions, in fact, root themselves in this Dharma position of confidently self-righteous in things that are basically lies. The third thing, lacking self-respect that comes with a commitment to speaking truth, almost breeds lying. So if you lack the self-respect that comes with commitment to speaking the truth, there's lies in the offing for in that Dharma position. The fourth point is lying and self-deceit are inextricably involved when there is inappropriate sexual behavior or substance abuse. Indeed, the hallmark of abusive and addictive behavior is that we feel we have to lie about it. Fifth, forgetting that you are lying. After a while, you believe your own lie and your mind becomes deluded and confused. Sixth, thinking that you can tell the truth all by yourself, but this isn't so. You have to work it out with others. Seventh, being truthful at the wrong time, if not well received, can turn into a battery of lying. One becomes exhausted making one's argument and finally lapses into lying out of being too tired or impatient to care if one says the truth or not. And eighth, not distinguishing between harmful and hurtful. If what you say is true but hurtful to the other person, and if they receive it badly, you could easily slip into lying just to get yourself out of it. A more skillful way of saying something true but potentially hurtful is to spend a lot of time choosing your choice, you know, choosing your words. And the ninth one, when leaders of a sangha for purposes of power speak falsely, it brings a deterioration of trust among the people in the community. And then one might fall into this kind of speech in order to be accepted or liked. It breeds a very bad situation. And 10th, Suzuki Roshi's way was not to hate. And if you're hateful, your speech may end up being hateful. And lies spice up hate more effectively than truth. So that's another situation where lies come are easily brought forth. 11th, speaking without recognition of the limits of our vision. One benefit of studying the Bodhidharma's precepts is that they give us, always ultimate truths. Bodhidharma is speaking ultimate truths. That's why they're almost impossible to understand. But whether or not we understand, we know now that ultimate truths exist. And before this broader vision, we had a narrower vision. And even now, we're prone to speaking as if we existed as an independent individual self. That's what we do, really. And then lastly, Coben's view, intentionally telling a lie is obviously a useless thing to do. And yet we do it once in a while if we get caught up in some difficult situation. We lie tentatively, and then we get into more problems. And he emphasizes that the lack of a clear recognition that you lied has to be corrected. It has to be worked out. And I'm adding that working it out in oneself prevents one from believing one's own lie, or at least to see it in a broader context. And this opens the way to regret and repentance. Reb teaches that the way out of the habit of unwholesome speech is to remain upright in it. And remember from last week, upright means impartial. Impartial in a way that, thank you very much, I have no complaints whatsoever. Strict impartiality. So again, Reb teaches that the way out of the habit of unwholesome speech is to remain upright within it, that means impartial, and create friendly conversation between you and your habit of unwholesome speech. The light in all things is revealed through friendly conversation with them. You practice kind speech even toward your perversity. Would that Wanda had done that. Would that Wanda had practiced kind speech toward herself in her having to condemn her own people to death. So lastly, in this conversation about words and their inherent elusiveness, I want to go on record for pointing out two other aspects of a word. To me, a word in and of itself as an object is sacred. To me, the mind of a word, though expressed, still lives in the heart of the Buddha. The above discussion did not consider the word itself as an object with its own mind above and beyond meaning making. So here are some of the most important points from today's talk. First, there are six of them. First, even if we make our best effort not to lie, not to speak untruth, still we may feel we have many times spoken illusory words. Second, to me, a word in and of itself as an object is sacred. To me, the mind of the word, though expressed, still lives in the heart of the Buddha. Third, all speech based on self-concern is false or harmful speech, and speaking the truth naturally arises from selflessness. When we are caught in self-protection and self-promotion, we cannot speak the truth. In the end, truth speaking is the only way out of bondage to self-concern. Fourth, lacking self-respect almost breeds lying. Fifth, the way out of the habit of unwholesome speech is to remain upright within it and create friendly conversation between you and your habit. The light in all things is revealed through friendly conversation with them. You practice kind speech even towards your perversity. And lastly, both self-loathing and self-praise are tools in the service of self-concern. As long as the basic illness of attachment to self has not been cured, self-praise and self-blame will reign supreme. So we work on self-praise and self-blame by working on self-attachment, and we do that by working on truth speaking and by realizing that the independent individual self that we normally experience doesn't exist. There's only the interconnected whole, which we'll be able to experience in Zazen. So it's a little convoluted. We work on self-praise and blame by working on self, on our attachment. And we work on our attachment. Reb says you can only do that by working on truth speaking. And then, and also by, by reminding ourselves again and again that what we experience as our individual independent self is not true. Just reminding ourselves. So here are some ideas for reflection during the week. Koben Chino Otagawa says that even if we make our best effort not to lie, not to speak untruth, still we feel we have many times spoken illusory words, and the invisible realm surrounding words, the realm that makes our words illusory, must be continually held in our awareness. This invisible realm that makes words illusory. What are your thoughts about the invisible realm of words? That's point one for reflection. This invisible realm of words. What are your thoughts about that? And second, if you were Wanda, who was Jewish, when it was clear Hitler would take over, what would you have done? What would you have done? And third, connected with this, do you consider her choice to become a communist and work for their party lying? Why and or why not? How might it not be lying? Fourth, in the end, an option which, given her skepticism of religion, probably wouldn't have occurred to her was regret and repentance. Had she simply looked at her life with its huge imperatives, with gentleness and compassion, and later regretted her actions and asked for forgiveness, many things might have been different. So please give your thoughts about this one. Just give your thoughts about that one. And also my words, to me a word in and of itself as an object is sacred. And to me the mind of the word, though expressed, still lives in the heart of the Buddha. What are your thoughts about this statement? And the sixth one, when we're caught in self-protection and self-promotion, we cannot speak the truth. All speech based on self-concern is false or harmful speech, and speaking the truth naturally arises from selflessness. So these words of Reb's are very strong. And do you believe them? Could you give an example from your own life supporting your opinion? And finally, 7, lacking self-respect almost breeds lying. Do you believe this? I wonder if you have questions.
Gail, so the first question that we have is, what does not to preach one word is called no illusory words mean? I mean, we do have to talk.
I think it's referring to Coben's example of a cat, of the word cat, which is just a word. It's not a cat, it's a word. And so even if we make our best effort not to lie or not to say the untruths, we say them all the time because words themselves are illusory. And so just using words is basically just using words is lying. To me, if the phrase read, not to speak one word is no illusory words, could be called no illusory words. That makes more sense to me. And I wonder if that was actually Bodhidharma's meaning, but it says not to preach one word. And I get confused about that word preach, but I want to say that silence and enjoying silence more often, it can really help us, because much of what we say is habitual, and habitual talk weakens us and our relationships, even as we wish to strengthen them. So it's good to use silence more often in your conversations. One thing that I've learned just through being a psychotherapist is that silence almost always deepens. And you can use that with yourself to just get silent when you're mulling over something, or when you're angry, or when you're worried. Just let yourself be quiet and see what happens. But I sympathize with your question because this is a really, we're using words as we're talking about words are illusory. So it's a little bizarre, but yet we have to figure it out somehow of how to, since we have to use words and words themselves are illusory, we have to do something. We have to make some understanding with ourselves. So I appreciate your question. Thank you.
Thank you, Kiel. The next one that we have is, what did you mean when you said the mind of the word, though expressed, still lives in the heart of the Buddha? This is very beautiful, but I really don't understand it.
Think of a word as a prayer. So no matter how many times a prayer is said or by whom, it's still powerful. It still has the same power. And nothing is taken away from it. And as a sentient being, each word is loved by the Buddha. You could think of it that way. And just because someone misused a word makes absolutely no difference to the power of a word or of its being loved by the Buddha. In Hebrew, I learned this when I was in Israel. In Hebrew, the word for, so my name in Hebrew is Bat Yah. And Bat Yah, Bat is daughter and Yah is God. So daughter of God, and Yah is also word. So in Hebrew, word and God are the same word, Yah. They're the same word. So I'm daughter of God and also daughter of word, which pleases me very much. Too bad we can't think of ourselves as a prayer. And no matter what we do, we're still loved by the Buddha. I think that's actually true anyway, even though we don't get it. And I also think that it would be a good practice, even if we don't believe it. There, no harm could come from it, actually. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next one that we got is, if lacking self-respect breeds lying, and I think self-respect breeds lying, which way do I turn? Is it a case of just knowing the difference, or did I misunderstand?
Could you read that again?
Yes. So if lacking self-respect breeds lying, and I think self-respect breeds lying too, probably that's what they're trying to say. Okay. Which way do I turn? Is it a case of just knowing the difference, or did I misunderstand?
As I'm understanding the question, it's about, since if it's true that lacking self-respect breeds lying, and I feel like I have that I lack self-respect, what should I do? If that's the question, I'm going to answer that question. So the question of what to do about lacking self-respect is, number one, have a a kind conversation, a friendly conversation with you and your self-respect. You can mention, when talking to your self-respect kindly, that there's no reason for, there's no reason not to remain upright in your lack of self-respect, that and in remaining upright, you can honor that you have lack self-respect, but that that's the truth, and you're going to look at it directly, and you're going to be impartial. Like, you're not going to hate yourself. You're not going to have strong feeling. You're just going to notice. You're going to be curious about how this happened to you. So notice that I just said happened to you, not that you are. You see, that's the big confusion. When you, a person who lacks self-respect, believes that that's the truth. They actually believe that they're bad, or they aren't a good person, they don't deserve whatever. And that in itself needs to be looked at straight on, and had up a friendly conversation with that part of you that believes that you're not worthy, at least as worthy as other people, to what, be in the world. That's all. Once you remain upright within your lack of self-respect, and are emotionally impartial to it, and have friendly conversation with it, I can't predict what will happen, but that's the road that I suggest that you take. And I suggest that you take it. I urge you to take it if that is you. Because I myself think it is true that lacking self-respect breeds lying. First of all, it is a lie. We aren't deserving of lack of self-respect. And so it's a worthy enterprise to have a friendly conversation with your lack of self-respect. I hope that's helpful. That's all I really have to say.
Thank you, Gail. So the next comment that we have is, when you said, if someone else doesn't share the same culture, education, childhood, sense of values, etc., there's little hope Coben will make his point at all. But in the other person's mind, a point might be made, and they agree, and no one even notices that nothing accurate has been said. I was thinking about the Alaya consciousness. We've talked several times about how it stores every single action, and possibly thought that we've made at least in this lifetime and maybe previous lifetimes. If you add that to what goes on in our conversations, it's amazing that anyone understands anyone. Certainly, we have to pay we have to pay attention to what the other person is saying. Many of us are multitasking while we're talking or possibly on our cell phones, having two conversations, just saying.
Thank you. Your words are very powerful, and I have nothing to add. Thank you.
So the last question probably that we have is, can't not saying anything also be a lie?
That's a really good question. And yes, it can. And I'm particularly noticing the prevalence of what's called ghosting in today's world, which is, it's almost the norm, in fact. And that's not saying anything. That's just dropping the whole, you're having a conversation with someone and someone just disappears. And that's so, depending on how involved the receiver was, it can just be so painful and just go on and on because there's no resolution. There's no conclusion to this relationship and someone just disappears. And so it avoids the truth, this kind of ghosting, which is one way of being silent, not saying anything. It avoids the truth rather than going straight toward it and expressing it. Saying the truth requires strength and willingness to be thoughtful and to go through the process of self-articulation. And so I call ghosting coward silence. It's a kind of coward silence. But not all silence is coward silence. And when it's not, I think it can evoke the truth. Silence can evoke the truth. So I think it can do both. There are silences that just lie in and of themselves, and there are silence that evokes the truth just in the stillness of it. I'm sure there's more than two kinds of silence, but those are two kinds of silence. I hope I didn't get you more confused than you were when you asked the question. But basically, yes, not saying anything can also be a lie. And I see I better stop. And I want to thank everybody here for being here and making these talks possible. And I want to thank my team, Sahar, and Brian and Brendan. And I want to thank the people who come later during the week and listen to these talks on their own. And I look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye.